Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for this first hour. Boy, oh boy, it was a busy week full of calls that I had, almost 10, sometimes 12 calls a day throughout the week. I had a lot of daily editorials and a lot of company introductions and follow-up interviews, following up on news. Please, everybody, keep those emails coming to me. I know that the sector, especially for precious metals, has been relatively slow, but there's still some companies out there with some good news, and that news does move some of the stocks. So, as I said, keep those emails coming. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a bit more broadly on the financial markets and try to look past all this volatility that undoubtedly will continue into the election. And who knows how long the actual election results are going to take. But fact of the matter is, we need to understand some of the bigger term trends that are at play here. I'm happy to say that I'm kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor. He is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, and also for the retail trader, writes in the No Trader, and has also started up a new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 total spider ETFs. Rick, let's start off with the U.S. equity markets. Broad question for you being, is it surprising to you that we have U.S. markets, something like the S&P that just a week and a half ago was testing out nearly at all-time highs, a broad melt-up heading into an election and a nasty election? This isn't typical for what we see during the couple weeks and even couple months heading into an election. What's going on here?
Hey, Corey. Well, I think it's a combination of a few things at play here. Of course, the Fed has been very accommodative, continues to be, and lets it be very widely known that they will be in the future very supportive of the markets. And that's not something that is normally the case going into an election, especially a presidential election. The country hasn't typically come back from, well, certainly has never had a virus to deal with like we have going into this election. So there certainly have been things at play here that are atypical compared to just your average presidential election. So you have an accommodative Fed. And the other thing that I think is keeping the market somewhat well bid, you know, we sold off in September and it's come back a bit. And the S&P is, I don't know, 100 points, give or take, 125 points from its all-time high. Why is the S&P trading at 3460? And what my take is, because Biden has basically held a double-digit lead in the polls, I think there's just more and more feeling that you could end up getting this what's been called this blue wave, you know, where the Democrats control the White House and now possibly end up winning enough Senate seats to take control of the Senate and hold on to their majority in the House such that they control all three houses of Congress and essentially be able to pass a stimulus package much more quickly than what we see in day in, day out headlines going back and forth. In the last week, it's been Pelosi and Mnuchin talking, but nothing gets resolved. It just doesn't get done. And, you know, getting if the Democrats can pull off a sweep like that, then I think it's fairly good for the markets. Months ago and even last night on the presidential debates where President Trump was saying that if Joe Biden gets into the White House, the stock market's going to crash. I don't think the stock market's going to crash. Could it come off, 5%? Sure. Could it come off more than that? It could even come off 10%, but coming off 10% is not the end of the world with it being where it is now. It'd still be kind of north of 3,000. And, it's not the worst thing. So I think the market generally holds up now because the factors at play, including an earnings season that we're still young into this third quarter earnings season, but so far the bulk of companies have beaten estimates, so you're having a decent earnings season. Once again, analysts are too conservative in their research reports on where companies are going to report, and I think the market generally is okay. And again, if it falls back, I've had for, I don't know, 6 months, my preferred buy zone, and your listeners, you know, might care about this because we got down to the top end of it on the September sell-off. I'm basically a buyer from just north of 3,200 down to about 3,050. That is my preferred buying zone that I have written out for months. So I'd love to see the market pull back. Give me a 10% pullback. Nothing I'd like right now more than that. I'd find it a lot easier buying stocks with the S&P at, you know, 3,100 than I do at 3,400. So I'd be very happy to have a pullback, and it's not going to spook me out. I've told people, have resting bids in that area, you know, kind of scale down your bids and start at, I'd say, 3,210, which is basically the September low. And whether you want to do every 25 S&P points or however you want to play it, you know, scale down to like 3,050. And I think that more or less will contain the decline. And if it goes a little past that, that's fine. I don't see the market going hugely beneath that, and therefore I'm comfortable if that were to occur.
Okay. Now, Rick, is this comfort with the pullback also correlated with how high sentiment numbers have been? You and I haven't talked about this before, but I know that you work a lot with behavioral finance. And when we do see sentiment levels reaching, well, upper levels, extremes almost, we're not quite there yet. It means that sentiment's a bit too buoyant and pullbacks are needed. How do you view the current sentiment levels tied in with your call or your hope for, let's say, a 10% fall?
Often sentiment polls are not polling professionals, but polling individual investors or newsletter writers. And so they haven't gotten enough extreme. But yeah, they're certainly in the bullish category. And when they get very bullish, that's often when I start looking about making cases for why I might want to be bearish. Case in point, when the March sell-off occurred this year on March 23rd, the day that made the low, the poll I look at most had only 3% bulls for S&P futures, and that was one of the reasons why I turned bullish March 23rd. We haven't gotten anything close to that on the flip side, so you're not anything near upper 90s at all. For those figures. And a lot of people you talk to don't trust this market. So even though the market itself has held up, the sentiment figures haven't gotten overly concerning by being too bullish. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people still waiting for this market to pull back. And I'm not talking about taking out March lows. There's no reason to think that that's going to happen or would happen, especially given the fact that the Fed has said they will support the markets as they need to. So I think it's pretty safe to say there's nothing that's going to happen unless we go into a full-on depression that would have us revisit 2020 lows. So if you got the chance to buy, you know, the S&P 3100 or 3000 or anything near there, I think you do it. It's not quite mid-range of what we've seen this year. But I think that it makes sense to do that, and you still have an accommodative Fed. And at that point, with the market coming off, if that were to happen, you probably get sentiment right down much more towards, you know, 50% bulls, 50% bears. And with a Fed that's really backstopping this the market from falling considerably, I think that would, you know, that's my sweet spot.
Rick, let's look into some of the sectors within the market too, because there has been this broad rotation. We're not seeing just a handful of high-flying tech stocks lead these markets higher. The rotation has brought in better breadth and, well, this still better sentiment levels in general. When it comes to your 7-Eleven report, what are some of the sectors that you think have a sustainable bull market, a longer-term run ahead of them?
Okay, well, you know, most people are going to start off by thinking about how is technology going to play. It's the largest piece of the S&P, and it's somewhere around, I don't know, I put it at 27%, give or take, of the total S&P. So nothing comes close to it as far as the proportion of the S&P. So technology should always be on people's minds, and the question is there still room for the growthier part of the market, especially in the technology sector, to keep performing the way it has? I'm getting some signs that it is starting to tire. I think unless you are a pure kind of scalper trader, you've got to always have exposure in XLK or something that represents the technology sector. And then it's just a question of, do you want to be overweight the whatever benchmark you're using to represent technology, or equal weight, or if you're really, you know, kind of speculating that tech has seen the best it's going to see for a while, then you go slightly underweight. I wouldn't go heavily underweight. I still think it is the future. So tech is something I'm always going to want to have exposure in, and it's a matter of, I've been overweight tech for a while now. We are overweight tech in the 7-Eleven report. I will probably cut it back a little bit on the November 1st issue. And that's, you know, going into elections. I publish this either on the 31st. I try to get it in the hands of the clients on the 31st of each month, or the 30th, whatever the case may be, or certainly early in the day on the 1st. And, you know, so I've got to make a decision before the election results are, people come out for election day and the results are known, what to do. But I think that I would probably take my overweight down and get closer to benchmark weight. I don't think I'm ready yet to make any material move as far as it being a significant underweight. And the other area that I like going forward, and we put into the one of the seven spider ETFs last month, the only one I added that hadn't been there, so in the prior month I only had six on, is industrials, XLI. And I think that kind of regardless if Trump holds on and wins or Biden gets in there, that infrastructure in this country is something that's going to be needed to be invested in at the government level and at the local and state level. And so I kind of like industrials now, too. And I've, you know, I've pushed them up to a mild overweight. So we have XLI on. A little bit more than its benchmark total. It's a very small group, but like materials, which I think is only about 3% of the S&P, the last couple of months I've been running at about 6%, so I have been overweight them. I may take that back a little bit too. And consumer discretionary has done decently. You know, so far the places to truly have been avoiding are financials, energy, and then the interest rate sensitive ones, so you're talking about real estate and utilities. So those are your really bad underperformers this year. And financials certainly are trying to get a bid. You know, the problem is the market is so long financials that even with interest rates having moved up in the last several weeks and kind of a breakout above 75 basis points in yield terms in the U.S. 10-year, you haven't really seen a significant move up in financials. And part of that is, I think, the market is, and has been for a long time, waiting for rates to go up, and financials have been bid for by portfolio managers. So unless they really want to commit a lot more money to that sector, it's kind of, the names are cheap, but they're having trouble getting sustainable bids across the banks and the other pieces of the financial sector, simply because I think in general, portfolio managers are fairly long that anyway. But, you know, we monitor this and just avoiding even energy has been, you know, so far a home run. So we have not been in energy. I don't think we've been in staples, utilities, or REITs. So, you know, we've been able to outperform since we started the 7-Eleven monthly report on August 1st by being able to stay out of the bad sectors. And you will, you know, just think about it from simple mathematics. If you avoid the underperforming sectors, you will outperform the S&P. And, you know, that's our goal. And that's why people subscribe to my newsletter is to know when to shift into underperformers that will either start outperforming or simply underperform by a lot less, or tail off on, you know, the overweights and you cut those down. And so I'm constantly changing things there. It's like an active managed fund, but you're limited to no more than the 11 sectors, and we won't have you in more than 7 at any one time.
Yeah. Hey, very simple, very straightforward there, Rick. I always find it interesting to see which ones you're adding, which ones you're avoiding. Your comments on the banking sector, though, ties in perfectly with the next topic being the bond market. We're seeing yields, especially on the long end, creep higher. Even the 10-year was closing in on its 200-day moving average. The 10-year hasn't traded above that 200-day moving average since mid-2008. The 30-year, the yield there is creeping to levels that we haven't seen since May of last year, 2019. What's this general increase in the long end of yield of the yield curve? What's this telling you about what investors are expecting?
Well, what it says to me is that the economy is not as bad as most people think, because you wouldn't see the yield curve widen out if there was real concern and sustained concern. Now, today, you know, we finally hit the 200-day for the first time, as you say, in a long time. And that came in, I think, at 85 basis points. So it's, you know, we're finally hitting that. It's tailed off. So, you know, going to close out the week, it looks like 84 basis points is what it's going to be. But that's up decently this week, because last Friday, I think, was 74 basis points. So we gained 10 basis points this week. And then on a percentage basis, from 74 to 84 is huge. For 1 week, and I think you're finally starting to see people wake up to the fact that U.S. interest rates are not going down to 0% the way so many people had thought, that you'd have zero or even negative rates here on the 10-year. And what I've told clients is, as long as yields are above 64 basis points, so, you know, 0.64%, then this breakout is still valid. And only if we got back underneath 64 basis points would it then call into question, you know, the breakout in the yield. So I targeted on a move above 74 basis points that we would get to 93 to 94 as a target. You know, we've been moving up, and no surprise that because we hit the 200-day today that you're seeing some buyers show up in the bond market, or on a yield chart basis, you know, sellers against the 200-day move average in rate terms. But I think there's still a decent chance that we get our target at 94 and 93 to 94, and it may actually move higher than that. So to me, it all, as long as we're above 64 basis points, I'm going to play that this is a breakout.
Does this rising long end play into any changes that the Fed might have in terms of policy, in terms of maybe the bond market forcing the Fed's hands? Or do you carry this over to any sort of inflation or deflation narrative?
I think it's more of a, if I had to choose one or the other, I would choose it more as an inflation narrative. And one of the things I track on the front page of the supposedly irrelevant factors institutional report that I write Sunday nights, we kind of monitor 10 markets and how institutions are positioned within the markets and where they lay out kind of technically against reference points to help get a sense of, is the professional investment community banking on inflationary pressures or not. And it's been very, very neutral for quite some time. And a week or two ago was the first time we got any whiff of inflationary pressures. And I said, you know, we're starting to see it, but it's too early to call a trend that it's going to stay sustained that way. But at least we, for the first time in months, we saw some indication that down the road, there's some mild inflationary concerns. But again, it's too early for me to even call that a trend or make a declarative statement that the market is concerned about this yet. It's just the beginning signs of it. And I think the yield curve, I look at the 30s, meaning the U.S. 30-year yields minus the U.S. 5-year yields. That to me is, a lot of people look at 10s to 2s, and I do as a trading vehicle, but to get a better view of what the marketplace and the people who really care about the longer end of the curve, which typically pension funds, the fact that they have widened that out and broke above 120 basis points, which is where a significant downtrend line was. We got to 124. It pulled back to 120 last week. I'm not sure where we go out this week, but that should have moved back up again. And I think that's indicative also of a sense that down the road, there is some initial positioning towards an inflationary future.
Okay. Well, that is something it sounds like might take a little while, but I know central banks have been trying to get that inflation on track for a while. It's going to be very interesting, at least to me, to see where or what spurs that inflation, because boy, oh boy, central banks have tried everything and they have not been able to get that inflation that they want, at least in
not at all.
The way they measure it. Let's also talk about FX and commodities. The U.S. dollar still really struggling. It's actually closing in on a couple breakdown levels. As we wrap up this week, the dollar's in the 92 region. You carry that over to some of the commodities. Base metals have been doing better over the last few weeks to a month, but the precious metals, they've been stuck. Gold still right around 1900. Can't seem to get any moves up or down that are sustainable. How are you balancing out the weakness in the dollar and how that carries over to certain commodities?
So I still think that the dollar, we called the short-term bottom over the summer, and we got it perfectly when the dollar index got tucked just beneath 92. We called that a trading low. And we got to almost 95, and it's pulled back down. And right now, I think to close out the week, we're about 92.72. We're still just a smidgen above that long-term uptrend line that goes all the way back to 2011 that helped determine that low we saw over the summer. So we're pressing against it again. If we get any significant break under, I guess, about 91.80 or so, I think 87.5 comes into play in 2021. And if that's the case, and the dollar really does start getting a more meaningful breakdown, because remember, we got as high as 102 and change in March this year when the dollar rallied, when the world was falling apart, when COVID hit and the stock market sold off, the S&P got down to, what was it, 2200, the dollar was up over 102, and it's been fading ever since. So it's been going in the exact opposite direction that the stock market's been going. So as stocks went up, the dollar's been down. And if we take out the lows of 2020, then you potentially open the door for this move to 87.5-ish as an initial downside target from this from the breakdown. And that is going to help certainly the precious metals, which are priced in dollars. It's also going to help the emerging market type of investments. So I think, you know, a weak dollar is good for, take something like EEM, the ETF that's, you know, one of the most popular ETF for the emerging markets. Brazil, EWZ, any type of emerging market will benefit from a weaker dollar. And those are potential investments for people to look at too as the US dollar goes down. And if it goes down significantly, we get this break to new lows, then I think metals will move higher. And at some point, gold may even take out the high that it made this year, which is also its all-time high. Silver has been, a much worse performer than gold. It's not even near its all-time highs of $50 an ounce. It's been hanging out in the mid-20s. So silver potentially could have room to go, but gold is the psychological metal of choice as a hedge against inflation, as a hedge against anything going wrong in the world. It's always gold. So silver's obviously much cheaper. It's an industrial metal, not nearly as industrial as it used to be when it was used for film. And of course, X-rays still need silver, but now that everybody uses and has for 20 years, cameras and camera phones and those that are digital and don't use film, you have far less. You took away a lot of the industrial demand that silver was. But I play the silver market frequently. We've got clients long silver on the 7-year breakout. In the no trader, individual investor newsletter I do, we got long at about 16 and a half, and we still have having that trade on. So that's been a huge winner, and I do think it's finally time for metals to still be a significant recipient of investment dollars over time. But over the summer, I did call and say that I think the high in gold was made for the balance of the year, and that may very well still be the case. So I'm inclined to lean towards silver as a trading vehicle. Just for those of you listening who are not familiar, silver is going to be a much more volatile market than will gold. So, if gold's up 1% on a day, it may be that silver's up 2.5%. Just, it's gold on steroids. So it's going to sell off more and it's going to be bid up more typically. So depending upon if you like that type of price action, you lean towards silver. If you want something a little more conservative, then you play gold.
All right. Hey, Rick, we're going to wrap it up there. It's always great spending these extended segments with you. We cover a lot in terms of different markets and I think really what matters. And so far, following along with you, man, you're trading and you are on top of these markets. And I really appreciate you sharing your insights with our audience. Rick, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for taking some time. And we'll chat again after the election, hopefully with some more clarity.
Yes. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed the first couple segments there with Rick Bensignor. I am following up those segments with a replay from an interview that I had with Peter Buchvar that I posted earlier in the week. Peter's such a valuable source of information that I wanted to get his interview out immediately for all of our daily listeners, but I also did want to replay it here. I hope you all enjoy what Peter has to say. Hey, everyone. Welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. This daily editorial will also be featured on the weekend show because I am chatting with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group. Also writes the book report website, which I will post a link to, where that's where Peter shares his rundown of economic data, news headlines that move markets, and broad market moves. He shares those thoughts multiple times a day. I check that website out pretty much every day. Peter, let's start off with this overwhelming theory and concept that we are going to continue to get fiscal stimulus, and we're also going to get some sort of a stimulus package from the U.S. government. Now, the stimulus package has been very slow. We still haven't got it, but I think that also just works with the timing of the election and all the fighting that we are seeing between the Republicans and the Democrats. I don't care about necessary timing, but I want to get your thoughts on the market. Is it right to price in this fiscal stimulus?
Well, I like to refer to it more as fiscal spending, because it's not really stimulating anything. It's more filling holes and buying time to a vaccine and an economy that can get its legs back. I think in the short term, when you spend a few trillion dollars, you can sort of generate a level of activity that wouldn't have happened otherwise. But the problem with fiscal spending is it eventually runs out, and then you're sort of back to where you were. And we saw that with almost $3 trillion that was already spent. So you lop on another $2 trillion, it's really just more of a steroid shot. But again, part of that is on purpose, in the sense that it's trying to buy time. And I think that is what the market is hoping for. It seems like it's almost a very binary type attitude, and believing that regardless of who is going to be elected the next president, and regardless of who's controlling Congress, and regardless of the timing of it, that another few trillion dollars will be spent. Now, I think it's a mistake to think that if Biden wins, that a lot of fiscal spending is going to offset proposed tax increases. But that's the mentality that the market's taking, and I think that's why it's at 3,500 or instead of a level below that.
Now, what about the whole theory or question of where this money will land when we balance it out with a lot of the spending, a lot of the programs in the past seem to truly support U.S. markets? We are hearing more and more about maybe some sort of infrastructure spend. A few different ideas are being thrown around right now. Do you think that we're going to see a different outcome than the last few times when we have seen money be printed, where it really just lands in the markets?
No, there probably won't be any difference. Lower income people will get their checks, and there'll be added unemployment benefits, and there'll be money to the states, and money to help the airline industry, and possibly the leisure and hospitality industry, which obviously be a help to them. But again, that's more filling holes, but at least keeping those companies alive. I know there's this obsession with infrastructure spending, but remember that once that road is repaved, you're sort of back to square one again, where money in the private sector is something that is more sustainable if it leads to more permanent behavior, which typically is the case. I wish, you know, if infrastructure spending was the key, then Japan would have had an amazing 30 years. But it also depends on the productivity of that infrastructure spending. I mean, obviously, a bridge that needs to be repaired or redone needs to be redone, but it makes it sound like we don't have infrastructure spending in the U.S. Every state, if you add it up in the aggregate, spends a tremendous amount of money on infrastructure. I mean, who hasn't been on a highway recently where there hasn't been construction of some sort? And it's always the case. There's always infrastructure spending going on in some fashion.
Yeah, that's a very good point, too. But Peter, when it comes to market moves on the back of expectations of consumer spending, we've seen a lot of the recent data show that markets, the confidence level is still quite high from investors. And considering how much volatility and uncertainty there is, I consider it almost extreme levels of how confident investors are right now. How important is it for the markets and even for the government and central banks to keep investor confidence relatively elevated?
Well, I think that we've seen over the last 20 plus years, going back to Greenspan, how Fed policy was meant to engender confidence, and the Fed put and so on And that's certainly the case now that the market believes that somehow zero rates and QE is some sort of backstop. And now you have the possibility of fiscal spending joining that monetary policy and creating that backstop. But I think we also have to remind people that that could work for a period of time. But the last two bear markets in stocks, and I'm not saying that we're going into a bear market, but the last two bear markets in stocks were met with massive Fed easing that did not stop those bear markets. So it works until it doesn't. And yeah, right now there is confidence in the ability of central bankers and politicians to print and spend a lot of money. But at some point, you're going to need some fundamental results from that. And we'll have to see. I continue to believe that the end result of this will be inflation and higher long-term interest rates. So whatever short-term benefit we get now is going to be offset by that over the next 12 to 24 months.
You think it could happen that quickly, hey? Because inflation was the next road that I wanted to go down in this interview. You think inflation's moving higher and could be moving higher in the near term?
I think we're already seeing that. We're already seeing that in PPI and CPI. The headline CPI index, as well as the core CPI index, the index itself, not the rate of change, but the index itself, is above where it was pre-COVID. So for all the talk about a deflationary bust and disinflation, this and that, the inflation index has never been higher, both on a headline level and a core level. So we've just gone through a pandemic, and the inflation statistics have never been this high. And we're seeing inflation on the good side in particular that has picked up. That was a missing piece of the inflation puzzle looking at over the past 10 years. So I think the early signs of it are already here. We're also seeing it in inflation expectations within the U.S. TIPS market. We've seen it in expectations within consumer confidence surveys. We're seeing it in the price of gold. We're seeing it in the price of food right now, price of industrial metals, and certainly the price of transportation. If you need to ship something by sea, air, or truck, you're paying double-digit rate increases versus last year. And every single thing in this world that is produced ends up on a truck, a ship, or a railroad, or a car, or an airplane at some point in time.
So is this going to carry over to what Jerome Powell's been saying? The Fed wants inflation over that 2% target to even out or average out all that time it was under 2%. Is he going to finally start accepting that inflation is running?
As dangerous as their desire is, if fulfilled, they will unfortunately get what they wish, what they are wishing for. And they will regret having it once they see it.
Oh, yeah, I think they will as well. But boy, oh boy, they have been in front of everybody, Jerome Powell especially, saying that they want higher inflation and they're going to use whatever tools and maybe some new tools to get there, except for the fact that they're also not predicting inflation to reach some of these levels in some of their forward forecasts. Let's move over to the actual markets now, because we've seen a little bit of a rest in these high-flying tech stocks that really kept on pushing the markets higher. We've seen a bit better breadth. We've seen some of the lagging sectors, just a general rotation of money. How sustainable is this trend in your eyes?
I think the sustainability will be dependent on whether we continue to have slow growth, low inflation, low interest rates, or we get a pickup in growth, pickup in inflation, and a pickup in interest rates. Now, we won't really know until 2021, but I think one of the key variables in answering that question is whether we have a vaccine or not that is going to get rolled out in the beginning of next year. I think that if that is the case in March, April, May of next year, people start getting it and starts to give people more confidence and for companies to invest, for households to go out for dinner and feel safer and so on, and go to a movie theater or a sporting event or eventually a concert, that's going to lead to a pickup in growth. That's going to lead to higher interest rates. That's going to lead to higher inflation. That's going to lead to lower PE ratios for the big growth stocks. And it will benefit those stocks that have been most beaten up, like leisure and hospitality, transportation, particularly airlines. It would help the bank stocks because they would get a steepening yield curve. It would help the energy stocks or other commodity stocks. And those are the value parts of the market. So I think that would be, as I say, I think the vaccine could very well single-handedly be a key contributor to whether this is sustainable or not.
But can investors bet on a vaccine right now? It's still seeming to be a pretty muddy picture in terms of if any vaccine is going to work.
Well, we're going to get some news hopefully in the next couple of weeks or early November from Pfizer on their phase 3 trials. And then probably by the end of the November, they're going to release the safety aspect of that. And that will be the first hint of whether we're close or we're not close. We know that we're beginning to get some effective therapeutics, which I think is a big deal. And in terms of sort of biding time until we get that vaccine, that if people are confident that even if they do sick, that then there's plenty of medicines to take to quickly get over it. I mean, this is going to be a process. It's going to be a long process, but a lot of it's about confidence. And I think the direction of the medicine in terms of its results will be a key contributor to that confidence level and this economic growth.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Let's also talk about yields, because you mentioned that you'd see an environment where yields could be higher. In all fairness, you look at something like the 10-year, and that has been trending higher slowly, but it is still trending higher over the past about month and a half now. Is this going to be a continued trend of yields just creeping higher?
Well, I think the day we walk in and Pfizer does have good news in the vaccine, it won't be a creep, it'll be a spike, and that you'll see a 10-year yield of 1.25 rather quickly if Pfizer has something good to say.
Does that mean that other safety plays, such as, say, gold, would that get hit hard if there is some developments or an actual announcement of a vaccine?
Maybe initially, but when people realize the inflationary implications of this, and it means that the Fed is going to way overstay their welcome, and still keep rates on the short end pinned at zero. So, yeah, you may get a rise in long rates, but because of the inflation that I anticipate being moving higher faster than rates, I do expect further deeper negative real rates. And also the dollar could weaken as people become, you know, the dollar is in this sort of safety trade. If there's less need for that safety, the dollar could weaken in addition to seeing further negative real rates. Now it would actually benefit gold and silver after any initial reactions.
Okay, that was going to be the final market that we talked about here, the U.S. dollar, which really broke down over the last about 6 to 7 months, had a short little rebound. You still see some weakness in the dollar ahead of us, though, hey?
I do. I think that the bull case in the dollar is, well, everything else is terrible in comparison, and there's this dollar shortage. And you know, I argue that, at least from a trade deficit, a current account deficit, a budget deficit standpoint, all these different deficits the U.S. is facing is actually more dollar negative compared to other countries, is the most dollar negative. And just the budget deficit, which is now 15% of GDP, now that'll shrink next year, assuming the economy rebounds, but it's still an extraordinary level. And if you can chart over the last 30 years, the U.S. budget deficit as a percent of GDP versus the U.S. dollar, and it's a pretty good corollary. And we've seen the plunge in the budget deficit relative to GDP, or I should say spike, in terms of deficit. And I do expect over the next year or two, the dollar to follow.
All right, Peter, we're going to wrap it up there. It's always interesting hearing what you have to say about the markets and this conversation, looking a bit past some of the short-term news and volatility that we continue to get from the election. But still, we need to note what's going on with COVID, what's going on with any sort of vaccine, and how these markets are trading, because boy, oh boy, in these volatile times, people can sure get distracted by a lot of other aspects that really won't have longer impacts on overall trends. Again, Peter does write the Book Report website, www.bookreport.com. I will post a link below. Peter, it's great having you on the show. Thanks again for taking time, and I hope you have a great rest of your week.
Thanks, Corey. Always fun. You too.
All right. right. Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm wrapping up this hour with a company update from Aztec Minerals, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol AZT and on the OTCQB under the symbol AZZTF. Now, I wanted to feature Aztec on the weekend show because the company released some drill results from its Tombstone property in southern Arizona. These are some pretty impressive drill results, and that's what I like to feature on the weekend show particularly. I'm chatting with the president and CEO, Simon Dykoski. Now, Simon, the headline numbers here says Aztec intersects a little over 6 grams per ton gold and about 77 grams per ton silver over about 15 meters, a little over 15 meters at the Tombstone Project. Now, there were a total of 4 holes released, all from this 4-hole spoke pattern, the north side of the project. You and I chatted at the tail end of September about the initial results from the central spoke pattern. Now we're talking about the northern spoke pattern, and we saw some of the best drill holes to date from this project. Start us off with just a little summary of these drill results and what they mean for the bigger project, please.
Yeah, sounds good, Corey. Thanks very much. So as you mentioned, these 4 holes, holes 6 through 9, were drilled about 300 meters north of the previously released 4-hole spoke pattern that we drilled in the center of the pit. And as you mentioned, actually hole 9 was the highest reported grade drill hole at the Tombstone open pit, the contention open pit reported to date. So we were thrilled, as you mentioned, 6.18 grams of gold, 77 grams silver, or 7.15 grams gold equivalent over 15 meters in hole 9. And this was fairly shallow. So again, we're thrilled with these results. And what we're doing with this drill program is validating a theory that, just to remind your listeners, this is a historic silver district, 32 million ounces of silver mined between 1878 and 1939. And this was primarily done by old-time miners chasing visible bonanza-grade silver veins. So we're drilling into the rock, into the pillars, around the stopes and tunnels that they've left, and testing the theory and confirming some previous drilling that suggested that that material was mineralized to the extent that it could be mined profitably in a bulk tonnage heap leach scenario. A heap leach in the region typically today would mill something or process a grade of 0.4 to 0.6 grams gold. And in our first spoke pattern, the headline hole there returned almost 80 meters of 1.6 grams gold equivalent. So you know, well in that range and exceeding what a heap leach mine in the region would be able to turn a profit at. So we're thrilled to see that in the north end of the spoke pattern, we've actually hit high grade gold amongst holes that are more representative of a low grade bulk tonnage deposit. So that's, you know, that's extremely encouraging. And these are high grade underground mining numbers that reside just a few meters beneath the surface within the first 75 meters of the drill hole. So it's really encouraging for us. And it does prove to us that, you know, while these miners got a lot of silver and gold out of these bonanza grade veins, they didn't get all of it, all of the high grade rather. So, you know, we're extremely encouraged. And right now we've got the drill now about 400 or 500 meters south of the central spoke pattern. So that's almost a 800 meter strike that we're drilling along, testing a third spoke pattern there in the south before we're going to step off and test some targets to the west. So we're not even done half the program in terms of reporting results. And so far it's as a phase one program, it's completely been a success, and we're extremely pleased that this theory is being confirmed.
So one other thing I want you to address is within this hole 9, a broader interval of almost 30 and a half meters of little over 3 grams per ton gold and 45 grams per ton silver. So a broader intercept here starting from just 32 meters depth. That really speaks more to the bulk mining scenario, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we're looking for, is mineable widths outside of the tunnels that are encountered in the drilling. And that's what we've been seeing. So it's so far so good.
Now, in terms of follow-up drilling here, I know that you guys still have the rest of this program to finish, but how do higher grade results like these play into your future planning for following up here?
Yeah, so good question, Corey. And, you know, this phase one drill program will vest our 75% interest with our partners on the project. So once we've completed drilling these 20 holes for approximately 3,000 meters for our phase one, we'll have met the earn-in, we'll form our joint venture, and then discuss with our partners what a phase two infill program would look like along this contention structure. And to be open and honest with you, it's hard to determine that at this point when we've only got data back from half the holes. And I'll point out that we have not even drilled we have several targets to the west of the open pit that we haven't tested yet. So it's an open question at this point, but you know, we've got lots of information to work with, and we look forward to that phase two. And in fact, we are also pre-collaring two deep drill holes. So these are to test deeper CRD style targets. So these are below the shallow epithermal gold-silver targets that we're drilling in the contention pit. These holes are more in the order of 750 meters deep. They require core drilling. And in order to efficiently core drill, we are going to pre-collar them with the reverse circulation drill that we have on site now. So that'll be next up after these 3,000 meters are drilled. And then we'll likely be into a phase two once we've had ample opportunity to discuss phase two with our partners and how we're going to move forward on the project.
Okay, so consistent drilling, it sounds like. Just remind everybody the cash position of the company to continue these programs.
Yeah, so we are sitting at over $2.5 million right now, and that's great. We actually had a number of warrants come in recently, so it drove a little bit of the share price weakness over the last few weeks, I think. But they expired yesterday, October 21st. These were 25-cent warrants that had been issued before the IPO. So very long-term supportive shareholders had these. And I think it drove a little bit of the share price weakness. So, you know, presenting a good opportunity for new investors to come in here at, you know, what I would consider to be a discounted price given the success that we've had through the drill bit thus far. And it has cashed up the company. Over $500,000 came in from that. So we're sitting good for cash. There's no immediate need to finance. And, you know, we're in a position to continue working here and to continue to produce results for the market.
Okay, thanks for those insights on the warrants being exercised, because I do want to ask you about the trading pattern on the back of these results. The stock did pop. It moved up about 15% on the day the news was released, but as I was watching trading that day, the stock opened up much higher, and same thing happened on Thursday. That's actually when we're recording this. The stock opened up gapping higher, but has seen some selling throughout the trading day. Do you think this is just continued selling from some of these people that did exercise their warrants? Any insights on here?
It very well might be. There were 2.5 million warrants at 25 cents that were in the money as of yesterday on their last day of expiry. So it's entirely possible that some of that selling, maybe even likely, has been from investors holding those warrants. And, you know, more broadly speaking, I think any precious metal investor over the last 2 months has seen a bit of a large retracement from the outright froth that we saw in July, June and July. So I think it's a normal trading pattern for the stock, given that structural imbalance with the warrants and as well as the general precious metals markets. And, you know, we're hopeful that once we get past some geopolitical events in the next few weeks here, namely the U.S. election and the resolution to that, that we'll see higher precious metal prices into 2021 and resume that uptrend in the macro markets.
All right, let's wrap it up with a comment on expected news flow. Obviously, continued drill results from this southern spoke pattern, some of the drilling to the west. How do you envision the news flow for the company, let's say, going into year end over the next couple months?
Well, it's going to be very busy. So, you know, as you pointed out, we're in the middle of the drill program. We've put out 9 holes. The pace of releases has been about 3 to 4 weeks between, well, it's been 4 weeks since we released our last batch of results. So the labs have been good to us. So, you know, we'd expect to be in a position to announce more results in November and then subsequent to that. And then we also hope to have something to discuss about our other flagship project in Mexico, actually a larger project, Cervantes, the gold, copper, porphyry, where Aztec made a discovery in 2018 of a drill hole that returned 160 meters of 0.77 grams in an open pit heap leach environment. So we hope to have something to discuss there with investors in the near term, and you know, further updates on forming the joint venture with our partners at Tombstone, and potentially discussing what our work program at Cervantes and Tombstone are going to look like next year. So lots to look forward to, and I think we'll have steady updates and plenty of touch points to discuss our progress with investors over the next 2 months.
All right. Well, Simon, in full disclosure, I am a shareholder of Aztec Minerals. If anybody has any follow-up questions, please email those to me, fleck@kereport.com. I will get those answered for you. And hey, please listen to all the daily editorials that I have released throughout this week. It was a very busy week. A lot of other important company updates, but I did want to save Aztec for the weekend show because of these drill results that did move the stock higher. It's nice to see investors still having cash, moving it into companies that are releasing good results. Simon, I really appreciate your time on this weekend show. Everybody else, thank you for tuning in. I'll be back at it Monday morning, so please, everyone, keep those emails coming. Simon, thanks again for your time. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Corey. You too.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.